Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, it's Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast. It's Monday, May 16th. That 180-page online rant by the alleged shooter in the Buffalo massacre is one of the latest examples of the dangerously divisive products of social media in our time. Not that racist massacres didn't take place before social media or before the internet, but it's a factor today, undeniably, in things like the spread of the hateful ideology of replacement theory that the alleged shooter referenced, the false conspiracy theory that there is a plot to replace whites and Christians in America. That is a fringe theory, but is spreading more widely, largely because of how easy that spread is to accomplish. NYU social psychologist and professor of ethical leadership Jonathan Haidt has an article in the May Atlantic magazine that takes a deep dive into how social media went from something people first thought would be culturally unifying as people shared posts with each other to the highly divisive thing it has become. The article, of course, was published before Buffalo, and Jonathan Haidt was already scheduled for the show today. We'll talk about the Buffalo massacre in the context of this piece, as well as the themes that it now connects with that Professor Haidt writes about. Jonathan, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much, Brian. Great to be back with you.
Your article begins with the biblical Babel. Why Babel?
Well, because it just felt to me like something had gone terribly wrong in the 2010s. And I've been casting around for metaphors to explain how everything seemed to change. And when I reread the Babel story, it's just this short little story from early in Genesis. And the key line is, you know, God sees the humans building this tower and he says, let us go down and confound their language so that they may not understand one another. And that just gave me, I think that's the best metaphor I found, because, you know, we have a lot of metaphors for tribalism and why our hatred across partisan lines is rising. But I think the real hallmark of what social media has done to us in the 2010s is that it has shattered any sense of shared meaning, any sense of shared narrative, and it puts us in these fragments. It turns us against each other. It makes us fear each other. And that's what life was probably like in the days after Babel was destroyed. Huh.
And you suggest that Babel isn't a story of tribalism. It's a story about the fragmentation of everything. What's the difference you're getting at there?
So the American culture war has been going on since the 60s or 70s as various political actors and parties get more geared up towards fighting the other side rather than cooperating. So that's been going on my whole life. I was born in 1963. But what happened in the 2010s isn't just an intensification of the left-right war. It's that people are now afraid of each other. Even, and this is actually very important if we get to the Buffalo story, when you look at a morally homogeneous institution, that is someplace where almost everybody is on the right, or an institution where almost everyone is on the left. Now, if this was just tribalism, those places should be happy places. They should all be exulting in their shared vision of you know, what's going on. But in fact, it's in those morally homogeneous places that we actually see a lot of fear, a lot of internal conflict, a lot of division. So that, I think, is something that's newer. And that can be explained by the fact that social media gives people an incentive to shoot, as it were, shoot with dart guns is the metaphor, to shoot people on their own side. We're not just attacking the other side. We're actually attacking moderates on our own side. We're attacking leaders. We're attacking everybody.
You look back, and this was one of the most interesting things about your article for me, to the years around 2003 or so, with the early social media platforms like Friendster and MySpace, in the more optimistic context of a theory called non-zero. So what's non-zero, and how is it connected with early social media?
So non-zero is this really brilliant book by Robert Wright. It came out in 1999. And I read it, and Bill Clinton read it and wrote about it. And it really captured the zeitgeist that was clear in the 1990s. We just, you know, the Cold War was over. People were saying the end of history. And what Wright pointed out is that there actually is a direction to history. And even if you look at biological history, from the first single-celled organisms to multicellular organisms, there is a direction in which systems find ways to cooperate at higher levels. And that's very hard to reverse. And that's human history as well. And so in the 1990s, there was a great deal of optimism. And with the arrival of the internet, it was clear, like, wow, you know, no more long distance charges, and say nothing about paying for long distance telephone. Like, you can see each other and you can talk to anyone in the world for free instantly. I mean, it was quite amazing. So I'm not saying that the thesis of Wright's book was wrong, because Wright does say that there can be some huge declines. But he does say that in the long run, over time, we get more cooperative. And that probably is still true. It's just that right now, I believe, social media has taken us on a very large downward jag.
Well, Facebook really became dominant around 2008. You remind us in the article, and you cite the year 2011 as a high point for social media techno-optimism. It's hard, even barely a decade later, to remember that there was a high point of social media techno-optimism. So why 2011?
So there were a bunch of different platforms that all launched around 2003, 2004. Facebook, as you say, it emerged by 2008. It was the dominant platform. And originally, these were just things to share, posts and photos, but gradually became more about the news feed. And then it's you opining on the newsfeed, and then it's you criticizing someone else for their comment on the newsfeed. So it becomes much more about political conflict. And the key innovations are 2009, Facebook adds the like button, Twitter adds the retweet button. And this just makes everything much more viral, much more explosive. The dynamics change because of those architectural changes. But even still, in those years there, we still were thinking, most of us, like, wow, this is the best thing ever to happen to democracy. And the key events in 2011 are the Arab Spring. I mean, what an amazing year. The year starts with the Arab Spring, where we're thinking, okay, you know, the communists failed in the 90s, and now democracy is going to come to the Arab world, we thought. And it ends with Occupy Wall Street. Like, wow, you know, income inequality has been rising for so long. But thanks to social media, more egalitarian movements are now powerful. So there was an extraordinary optimism in 2011 that social media was God's gift to democracy and equality. And that's where things begin to turn around. After 2012, and especially in 2014, is when we begin to see the first signs of the new and much more vicious social media.
So let me go back to these two tools, which are so easy to think of as simple and benign tools that you cite as at the core of turning things from light to dark on social media, the like button and the retweet button on Twitter. What's so sinister about liking somebody's post on Facebook or somewhere, or retweeting a post that you find interesting on Twitter? What's so sinister about that it could have turned the whole thing to the dark side?
Well, nothing is sinister about them, if by sinister we mean that there was some plan to, you know, that Mark Zuckerberg or Jack Dorsey had a plan to destroy the world. No, of course they didn't.
Yeah, and I didn't mean that. So maybe sinister is the wrong word.
Okay,
but I guess inadvertently destructive.
Inadvertent sinisterism, sure. What happened was once users are able to like things, well, that's a huge amount of information about what you find engaging. And so Facebook was all about increasing user engagement. They literally gave bonuses to engineers if they could find a way to keep people on the site longer, if they could find a way to get them to post more content, give us more data. That's how they make their money. And so the like button allowed them to know exactly what engages people. And then they developed algorithms. The algorithms weren't really there beforehand, but they become ubiquitous after that. Algorithms to give people more of what they want, or certainly what engages them. The retweet button, when then Facebook copies it as the share button, is even more powerful. If you think about how information spreads, you know, it's one thing if you tell me something, then I call up five friends and tell them on the telephone, but that takes a long time. Whereas if I can just touch a single button and it goes out to my 3,000 followers, each of whom has an average of, you know, a few hundred or thousand followers. So with just a few clicks, millions of people can see something. And this becomes extremely important when we talk about people who otherwise would be sort of isolated and alone with their strange beliefs, and they would die out. But now it's very easy for people to find each other and create these communities of shared belief.
But for you as a social psychologist, you must either believe that you're observing with the way people use like and share and retweet, that human nature gravitates toward liking and retweeting the most divisive possible things.
Yes, it's not. It's what the research shows is that people especially love to broadcast things that display anger at the out-group, anger at the group that your group hates. So, of course, you could have lots of positive stuff about your group, but bad is stronger than good is a general psychological principle. And so, yes, it is the device of information. But I'd like to steer people away from the obsessive focus on information. Everybody's looking at fake news, information. Where do people get this? These bad ideas? I'm a social psychologist, and I'm not as interested in information as I am in social dynamics. And this is what is extremely powerful, is that we're really good at sussing out, you know, what do people think around here? What is the common sentiment? We want to fit in and we want prestige. We want people to respect and like us. And we evolved to live in small communities, small groups in which our social senses can do that. But then you put us into this distorted funhouse of social media where you have no idea what the average person thinks. All you know is what's going viral at this moment. All you know is the things that come through your feed, which have very little correlation with what people actually believe. But what you know for sure is that it's much more radical, much more extreme, much nastier. Most people are quite nice. Most people don't want to attack others. But you wouldn't know that from being on Twitter or Gab or many of these other platforms.
So replacement theory as one example, and the way it's spreading as we tie this now potentially to the Buffalo shooter?
That's right. So, you know, as I heard just a few minutes of your previous conversation just before the hour, and of course, as people know, there are many, you know, this sort of thing has happened. The Pittsburgh shooting was almost identical in its ideology. And what I can add to this is I've been studying morality. I study moral psychology, and I've been very interested in extremist moral movements. And back when the Oklahoma City bombing happened in 1993, well, Timothy McVeigh, when he was caught, he had a book on him called The Turner Diaries, which is kind of the Bible of this sort of movement, written in, I think, the late 70s. But it is all about the great replacement theory and how Turner, the hero, flies a small plane with a nuclear bomb into the Pentagon. And so on 9/11, I thought, oh, my God, the right wing, these people, they actually did it. So it's a similar idea. But where you previously you had to somehow find a copy of the book and you had to know people and you had to maybe meet at a meeting where people traded copies of the book because you couldn't buy it in bookstores. So that was the dynamic for a long time. But now imagine that you take the connectivity of whatever the connectivity of people susceptible to these beliefs were, and you multiply it by 1,000, so that rather than having to get your way to a gun show where maybe somebody had the book, you just go online and there in your newsfeed is somebody offering you a PDF of the book and every book on great replacement theory. So it's really the connectivity. That's what has changed things. So this guy, in fact, you know, I just started reading the manifesto this morning. So if you just in the first few pages of his manifesto, he has a Q&A question. Where did you get your current beliefs? Answer, mostly from the internet. There was little to no influence on my personal beliefs by people I met in person. I read multiple sources from all ideologies and decided that my current one is the most correct. Now, I sincerely doubt that he actually read multiple ideologies. And certainly the fact that he live streamed his attack, he live streamed mass murder, indicates that he thinks his followers agree with him. And here's one other quote. Question, is there a particular person that radicalized you? Answer, yes. And his name is Brenton Harris, et cetera. This guy live streamed, his live stream started everything you see here. So in other words, we have this kid, like many boys today, and there is a boy crisis. I just read a wonderful forthcoming book by Richard Reeves on boys and men. Boys are increasingly disconnected. They're doing badly in school. They're doing badly in the job market. You have a bunch of disconnected boys spending all their time online. And boy, are they easy to recruit for these causes. So I think social media and the internet are going to give us many, many more of these kind of shootings.
Listener on Twitter asks, please ask Haidt why this ripping apart of society can't be attributed largely to the rise of a massively funded right-wing propaganda empire with no equivalent on the left.
Well, so if we look at the broader culture war, It is true. I think that questioner is correct that there's a much more organized effort by right-wing groups that goes back to the 70s, really, and it increases in the 90s. So that's definitely a part of the culture war. Now, there are a lot of asymmetries in the American culture war. And so on each side, people can point to the terrible things that the other side is doing, but they don't see the things on their side that the other side is pointing to. So the listener is correct that there's an asymmetry, but of course people on the right point to, well, you know, I mean, the left controls most of the dominant parts of our culture. They control most of the knowledge generating institutions, the universities, teachers unions, news, the journalism in general. So yes, all of these contribute. A culture war needs two sides. And the sick and sad thing about a culture war is the harder you hit the other side, the stronger they get. So there's a lot going on here that's gotten us to our current state of conflict.
And on the mainstreaming of this, some of this what we would normally call fringe stuff on the right, where does QAnon fit in to your theory and, you know, the made-up child sex ring kind of accusation? We remember it was once leveled at Hillary Clinton during the 2016 campaign, and then somebody actually went to the pizza place where she was allegedly doing this in the basement and shot up the pizza place. And there's a tweet that's in the news right now by upstate New York Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, who's part of the Republican leadership in the House now, and talking about the baby formula shortage. She tweeted, "White House, House Dems, and usual pedo grifters." That's pedo as in pedophile. "White House, House Dems, and usual pedo grifters are so out of touch with the American people that rather than present any plan or urgency to address the nationwide baby formula crisis, they double down on sending pallets of formula to the southern border." So, okay, if she wants to make an issue out of whether scarce baby formula should be used for people who are crossing the border illegally, that's a policy question that people can discuss. But she threw in there pedo grifters for House Democrats and White House and their colleagues.
Yeah. So conspiracy theories like this have been around for a very long time. They're not new. But again, don't look at the conspiracy theory. Look at the dynamics. So the fact that a conspiracy theory like this can spread so massively that it can change the course of the country, this couldn't happen without social media, without the newly viralized social media. And even more important, what I want to call attention to is this is a U.S. representative. This is an elected member of Congress behaving this way. That could never have happened without this new viralized social media. And here I point to a really brilliant center-right commentator, Yuval Levin, who has a book called The Fractured Republic. And I've heard him speak on podcasts where he points out that America's institutions used to be formative. They shaped us, they created us. And if you worked at the New York Times, we'd assume that you were a Timesman. You were, you know, shaped by the high standards of the New York Times, et cetera. And Levin points out that now our platforms are performative. That is, thanks to social media, you can get elected by spreading outrage on social media. And then once you get to Congress, wow, now you've got a really big platform. Congress isn't an institution that you owe something to. It's not a crucial institution of the country. It's just a big platform for you to tweet from. And eventually you'll lose, and then you'll just be on Fox News and other programs. So this is my main point in the article, is that social media has changed the social dynamics in ways that make us perform, not communicate. It doesn't connect us. It gives us a platform to perform. And our performance ends up intimidating people into silence, subverting our institutions, and basically tearing down the essential structures of a diverse, secular, liberal democracy.
Rufus in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Jonathan Haidt. Hi, Rufus.
Hi, Professor Haidt. Given the new dynamics and the connectivity, do you think that there should be a redefinition and maybe even a legal redefinition of incitement and hate speech? Thank you.
That's a really good question. I do think that, so I guess my broad answer would be yes, that we need to reconsider each of our key legal and moral constructs each time the technology changes. And so what was reasonable in the era of news, of early slow newspapers, might not be reasonable in the era of radio and television. And then that might not be reasonable now. So in general, yes, I do. But I also think that efforts at content moderation, which they're certainly necessary, but one thing we learned from Frances Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower, is that even Facebook, which does spend a lot of money on content moderation, even they can only get, I think she said a statistic, something like around 1% of speech that might count as violence and intimidation. And so it, more moderation, it, you know, trying to catch all the horses after they've left the barn, that is a hopeless task. Whereas what Haugen suggests is changes to the architecture so that bad stuff doesn't go so far so fast. It's really changes to the architecture are what we need to slow this stuff down rather than trying to please billions of posts.
That's so interesting because Governor Hochul, after the Buffalo shooting, said this. I'm going to play just a 7-second clip, and I want to get your reaction to it, and then we're going to be out of time. She says social media companies need to take ownership of the fact that things like this rant or what some people call manifesto was sitting there online and the shooting was live streamed.
They have the resources to do this. They need to take ownership of this because otherwise this virus will continue to spread.
So what does that mean? Maybe it's what you just said.
Yes, I think she's absolutely right, but I would put it in an even broader context. These companies grew up in a context of, hey, let's not regulate them much because, you know, they're American companies, they're innovating, let's let them grow, let's see what happens. That made sense in the late 90s and the early 2000s. It does not make sense now. I think, as I've been arguing, and as I suggest at the end of the Atlantic article, we need to rethink this from the top to the bottom. There needs to be a federal regulator that can put some fear into them that they actually are accountable, not just for content moderation, but for their dynamics, and especially for sucking onto them underage users, luring in 10, 11-year-old kids. So we have, as a society, we have to rethink what we've let these companies do. We have to put pressure on them, legal pressure. There are lawsuits brewing. There are states' attorneys general. All of this is good. Of course, we're not going to ban the technology, but we can't let it run roughshod over us, our democracy, and the rights of people. There are going to be a lot more of these shootings coming up.
NYU social psychology professor Jonathan Haidt, he has a major article in the May issue of The Atlantic about the fragmentation of everything and now tragically relevant to the massacre in Buffalo. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.